Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I am joined by Matt Veach. Matt is the managing director at Revisite. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Matt?
You got it, Revisite.
Fantastic. I know you are also the co-host and run Real World Wednesdays with Aaron, who was on the show not too long ago.
That's right.
Yeah, continuity Aaron, here.
Aaron Kabab is a good friend of mine, and conceptually, it was actually his idea. He approached me about co-moderating this show, which we named Real World Wednesday. It's a weekly podcast. We actually host it on Clubhouse and then use the replay to create the podcast. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to engage with a variety of different notable leaders in the RWD and RWE space. It's a lot of fun. And I completely understand your passion, James, for podcasts, because it really is a lot of fun to engage with people and just better understand more than you would get from that normal business introduction.
It's incredible. It certainly hooked me in when I started it. It started out a little bit of general interest, business development, but the networking opportunities it then brings up is just unlike anything else that you would ever come across. But let's talk about yourself, your role, managing director, your company. Give us a quick overview as to, the main line of work for yourself at the moment.
Yeah, so mine is a non-scientist. I come from a business background, grew up with business training, undergraduate degree in life sciences, and I'll touch on that a little bit more here in just a moment. But I essentially see my focus as the business of science. And that science can be, in this case, data science. Just over the last many years, I've gained great appreciation and then pivoted my career completely to focus on real-world data and the subsequent evidence generation use cases from that.
Right.
And it's an interesting story as to how that passion was fostered, and I'll share some of that as I go through my background. But today I have a full-time consulting practice, Revisite Consulting. Again, it's a portmanteau of revealing insights from data. Mm-hmm. And I'm very operationally focused, very focused on the facilitation of data access, that fit for purpose of the data for different research use cases is a major part of my focus. And I work with scientists and researchers to better understand their research needs and find the optimal data, and also work with data suppliers, those that are actually providing the real world data, to really help them in the commercialization of the data that they're making available.
Nice.
Non-identifiable data, of course, except for very specific research use cases where there's consented data, consented patients. And of course, those are much different and managed in a much different way. Those are actually research opportunities themselves.
I get you. Okay. You mentioned your background not being necessarily a scientist and pivoting into this space. And I ask everyone the same question, Matt, and that is how you ended up getting into this space. What drew you to it and how you got into the world of clinical research?
No, it's a great, I really appreciate the question. And first, I hope that James, being your esteemed guest, I hope I won't tarnish the reputation too much of Huxley Morton, probably the least of your interviewees, to say the least, but just a little bit on the journey. I started my undergraduate degree at the University of Colorado in Boulder and wasn't exactly certain what I wanted to do. I thought about physical therapy. I thought about chemistry. I was attracted to the sciences. I ended up completing a degree, actually in exercise physiology of all things, because I was really passionate about performance and human performance. But after graduating, I actually took a job at the National Jewish Center, National Jewish Health in Denver, Colorado, and was an exercise physiologist. I worked in the pulmonary rehab unit and was exposed to medicine, to science on a constant basis, and worked with the clinicians. And I gained a real appreciation for it, but I also realized I didn't have the passion to really pursue medicine as a career, or for that matter, science as a career. Mm. I was much more interested in the business aspects of making research work. And what I've come to realize over many years now, is just an aside, is that some of the biggest issues in medicine and science aren't actually the science and the medicine. It's the contracting. It's the process behind that creates all the barriers. And unfortunately, is the reason that a lot of research doesn't take place, because there are those business and budgetary constraints and considerations.
Oh, so for sure. It's massive, that aspect, isn't it?
It really is. And so that convinced me to depart from science and actually pursue a master's degree, MBA. Funny story, I had a variety of different roles, which I'll go through here in just a moment, but I was actually in four different MBA programs, completing 75% of three of them and 100% of one of them. All of this sort of back in the day, as the saying goes, before there were online education choices and things like that, I was having to withdraw from schools and starting all over again at different graduate schools.
Oh, it was tougher back then.
It was, yeah. At National Jewish, I was there for a few years, decided that I would pivot into focusing on business. And there was a research organization in Denver that was very focused in oncology research. And I joined them, gained a robust understanding of the CRO space. I moved to Chicago to work for a site management organization. And after about 2 years, that's where I was recruited into Quintile, Legacy right. Quintiles, as it was known. And initially, I started in a sales role, which was not bad. I try to be very engaging, and I love working through business opportunities. But it wasn't a great fit because I was always focused on the how are we going to make this work and the operations side of things. And what I found was that my real passion was for operationalizing research and making it more effective and making it more efficient.
Mm.
And also at that time, rather than becoming a line manager or going into line management roles, I pivoted to become a corporate intrapreneur. So I was setting up different business units within the company.
Yeah.
One of the more notable examples of that was the Public Health and Government Services Division, which was interestingly, after some research, we realized that the funding cycles of government and non-government entities, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they were a bit counter-cyclic. And that if we had both of those as focus areas in the business unit, then that would provide more steady access to funding opportunities, research opportunities.
Sure. And forgive my ignorance there, Matt. Counter-cyclic. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Government, when government funding cycles are increasing, typically the non-government are going down or stabilizing and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so that counter-cyclic nature of the funding cycles means that by focusing in both government and non-government at the same time, and many of these were product development partnerships with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, by focusing on both of those areas, we were able to have a steadier base of business for the company.
Gotcha.
And for me, it was very exciting because I found myself with these research opportunities, especially with the product development partners. I was traveling about 90% of the time.
Wow.
Internationally. And I don't mean just to major cities like London and Paris. I was all over the world. I was in Central Africa. I was in Eastern Africa, Uganda, Rwanda, South Africa, all over Asia, all over Latin America, the far reaches just south of the Amazon basin. And all of that being very hands-on sort of business and operations focused, essentially it was programmatic management. How do we programmatically manage these opportunities? And that was my focus, which I then really transitioned into programmatic management from a funding perspective. So these companies, whether they had a product that would be attractive to a government agency or a product that would be attractive to a non-dilutive funding organization like the Gates Foundation, we were actually helping them, these small biotechs typically, we were helping them to actually obtain funding.
Wow.
And that is why for a time I found myself within the NovaQuest division of Quintiles prior to its divestiture, so many years ago. And that was great for me to just learn more and be more broadly exposed to funding and venture capital investments, considerations that go into funding, and actually helping these small companies obtain that capital. And then advancing their products, again, program management, advancing those products in development.
Wow. And I'm very curious about all this travel, because I've recruited in God knows how many countries, probably similar to your list of how many places you visited. I've made placements in all sorts of countries. And I typically find that once you get past the language, past the culture, people are generally the same. Were the challenges that you were faced with in different countries different, or were they the same in terms of that business operational side? Were they the same or did they vary?
That's a great question, James. And I tend to agree. I think that a lot of their interests are regional, but when you break it down, people are very much the same. What I found probably more impactful on their everyday lives was just the infrastructure and infrastructure differences and trying to get across a crowded deli street or being a couple of miles away from my next meeting and having to go by rickshaw. You do what you have to do.
Wow, that sounds incredible. And how 90% of the time you were on the road, how did your friends and family respond to that? Because I'm a bit of a homebody. I'm sitting here in the UK. I've always been in the UK and in and around London. As much as most of my recruitment for many years was all overseas, don't like leaving my base. So how did you go about that? What is it about your character that was like, yeah, you know what, I'm up for traveling and I'm up for going to this country, to that country?
This was the abrupt or rude awakening for me, because the MBA that I had pursued was international business and finance. And I was really excited to get that international experience. And the downside of international is everything is international.
It's a giveaway there.
It means long plane rides. And I've literally been on planes 20 hours at a time. And I think for a while, it's exciting. Especially at first, it was like booking round the world tickets and being in 10 different cities in 2 weeks. And it was exciting, but it does wear on you. And I definitely felt that I was aging like five times faster. But I still enjoyed the experiences. And really looking back, it was the engagement with people locally and just looking at their drivers and what motivates them and building some great relationships, which persist to this day.
Yeah,
that's something that I wouldn't trade.
Mm.
However, after about 2 years of this just crazy level of international travel, I came home from a 5-week trip. And that's the other thing with these trips. It's not like you're gone for a week and home on the weekends. Mm. These are multi-week. So 5 weeks, came home, was going to be home for the weekend. And then I was leaving on another 3-week trip. And it was that weekend my wife said, "What's your next job going to be?" And it was very clear that, and with a young son at home at the time,
yeah,
and me becoming ever more interested in being home and being with him and experiencing that family life, I knew that chapter was drawing to a close. And fortunately, Quintiles was a great company to work for. It was a great company to learn from and to work with people. Now, you work very hard. Sometimes there was joking about being dog year, 7 years of experience in every year at Quintiles. And I, in many ways, I agree with that, but I loved every experience. And one of the things that was most notable about my tenure at Quintiles was the ability to have lateral moves, to move around the organization. I was so incredibly thankful for the IT organization because they welcomed me in as I was looking for opportunities that didn't involve so much travel.
Yeah,
they welcomed me in. And that is where I really started to develop my passion for real world data.
Uh-huh.
To share a little bit more on that, I, again, looking for different opportunities within the company, knowing that I had quite a background in research and development, and I was working with folks, engineers, IT individuals that may not have had that same background. So they couldn't necessarily tell you the difference between phase 1 and phase 2 and phase 3 trials, yet it was their core business. So one of the things that I was very passionate about was cross-pollinating that knowledge. So I was bringing R&D to them and they were bringing technical understanding to me. And I was learning about cloud computing and security and all these great, wonderful things. But it really solidified for me the power of data just in general. And where globally we were headed was more and more and more data was accessible and available.
Yeah.
And about that same time, there was these great changes in the regulatory framework. There were advancements. I won't go into all of the laws, the US regulations and things that changed, but the regulatory environment allowed, especially with real world data, what at one point in time was considered to be off-label use and a big no-no to even ask about, now is becoming formalized as real-world data to support evidentiary use cases and a new way of thinking about drug development and regulations. And I became really excited about that.
Yeah.
And after a couple of years, I actually rose to a position where I was with NIT. I was leading a lot of that outreach for the real-world data assets.
Wow.
And the platform at the time was called Infosario, and really very focused on obtaining access to those real-world data assets. And based on a lot of requests for more and more international data, I presented an idea of a partnership between Quintiles and IMS Health, who was well known to have a lot of international data. And initially, it was maybe not so well received because there were competing segments of the companies. And eventually what happened was I was given permission to set up the strategic partnership. And it advanced quickly. It advanced very well. And that seeded the $19 billion merger between the two companies. And by seeded, wow, the introductions were made across the executive leadership team, CEO to CEO. A lot of things came about as a result of that partnership.
Wow.
And the beauty of having that formal structured partnership during the silent period, during the actual M&A, we were able to continue communicating about actual projects. Obviously, there was a lot that we couldn't discuss, but yeah, we were able to talk about the business at hand and the client opportunities and things. And it was just a wonderful experience. And I worked with some really great individuals who have had more of an impact on me than they ever realized at the time.
Yeah.
And I cherish that opportunity. Now, I realized that the organization known as IQVIA came about as a result of the work of literally hundreds of people, because it went from me with a partnership to a team, small team of about 6 or 10 people that were managing and administrating. And then there was corp dev and finance and legal, and 150 people were involved. And for me, that sort of took away the intrapreneurial excitement. And I knew that it was time to focus on something else.
Yeah.
And so I actually pivoted to join Inventiv, which merged with INC to form Syneos.
Yeah.
And I was at Syneos for a couple of years. And I was leading some different initiatives, some with real-world data, others with, as they were known, remote research technologies at the time, now formalized as decentralized research, and really became very passionate about that as well. But after 20 plus years in the large corporate environment, I knew that it was time to do something different. And I wanted to convert from being an intrapreneur to being an entrepreneur. And I would do that with a toe step in the direction of entrepreneurship. And that was with a consulting practice. And so that was the inception of Revisite Consulting. And I had all the nervousness and trepidation of anyone that's starting any company of any size. Is it going to work? Am I going to have clients? What are going to be the biggest issues? And
what were your biggest concerns about that? Because it seems like you had some success and it had been generated as a result of your own passion and your own interest and perhaps a couple of mentors that you mentioned there. But yeah, what do you think it was that maybe flipped that switch?
It's a great question, James, because I think the nervousness came about, I didn't want to disappoint anyone. And all of a sudden, instead of being a team, it was a team of one. And it was all on me. And that, it's a big responsibility, but yeah, with the right balance of passion and entrepreneurial drive, you make it work and you make it successful.
Yeah.
And I had ups and downs. I didn't do everything great at first, but I learned, and I learned how to be much more effective, much more efficient, and to really strive to improve the relationships with my clients and make each one of those successful to the full extent that it could be. And that's one of the drivers that I have today in my consulting practice. It's to really understand the needs, really look at the critical drivers of success, and make each and every opportunity a successful one for those clients.
Yeah. Now, it's a big step, isn't it? When you, I guess, go from the kind of almost the comfort zone of a big company, the likes of IQVIA, Syneos, and you've got that support around you. It's great being a top performer there, but then when you realize that all eyes are on you, it's a completely different ballgame. Would you say there's any misconceptions or potential pitfalls that people should look out for if they're thinking about doing a similar thing and moving to the consulting side of things?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I have nothing against Excel. I use it all the time. It's a great tool. But if you're trying to manage everything from Excel spreadsheets, invoicing and all of that, that is a mistake. As a small business, there are so many specialized tools and applications that are fantastic. Having a good accounting system, having a good accountant, having good legal and contractual support, these are all critical. Setting up your entity, your company here in the United States as a limited liability corporation that offers great tax advantages, that's really the right way to structure. There's other options like S-corps and things like that. But initially, moving beyond that sole proprietorship to a small LLC, single member LLC, I couldn't encourage people that are thinking about consulting. I couldn't encourage them enough to properly formalize and have the right resources, the right accountants and lawyers. Spend the money. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but spend some on setting up properly. And then it really pays dividends back as your operational efficiency has so greatly improved.
I think so. And it's similar. I don't know the ins and outs of how an LLC works in terms of that setup, but it's similar for myself when setting up the business. For us, it's going limited. And that change, the difference when I started, it was just Lucy and I, was just so different, because it wasn't necessarily how much money you made, it was how much money you kept. And that was often the exactly. big thing. So as you say, the tax advantages are just unreal, but you've got to, as you say, you've got to invest in the right things so that you are playing the system accordingly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're doing everything, you know, the way that you should be and reaping the benefits of that. But after a while, you find that the limiting factor of a single member consulting practice is you, the resource. And you've only got so many hours in a day, in a week, in a year. And that's why I started to build out what I call a consulting consortium, which is pulling in other independent consultants into different projects.
Yeah.
And so then again, I put my program management hat back on and essentially manage it as a program with subcontracted, it's called 1099 contractors. And it works very well because you're able to pull in exactly the type of expertise that you need for a given opportunity each and every time.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to take the existing staff that you have, FTEs, and trying to fit that to a specific opportunity.
Precisely. Yeah. I guess if you can get that freelance talent where you're not consistently having to pay for them, you're just paying for the project, for the job, for that specific input, it is a lot more cost effective.
Absolutely. And the funny thing, James, you may appreciate this. Every client that I've had, or at least early on, every client that I had was offering me jobs.
Wow.
And I also realized that one thing that's very interesting about consulting is it's the best job interview that you could possibly have because you're engaging with a very senior leadership team that if you were to take a job, you would ultimately be working with.
Mm.
And so from a recruiting perspective, I think it's very interesting to consider that sort of temporary to permanent transition.
Definitely. And I think you're so right about you start operating at a much higher level, don't you? And
you're
dealing with the decision makers in businesses. And therefore, if you did ever want to go back to being an employee, not many of us do once we've made a success in consulting life, the network that you've built is so much stronger. And I think that's the thing, you've just elevated your career.
And the other thing is it allows you the opportunity to pursue other passions. And I mentioned that I was very passionate about decentralized research.
Mm.
And I was so pleased to be a co-founder of the Decentralized Trial and Research Alliance, DTRA.org.
Yeah.
And just that's another great experience where we've been able to engage with life science companies, with CROs, with the FDA themselves. Thankfully, they are a wonderful member. And we really are able to shape and look at policy and things like just the very glossary of how decentralized research is impacting the operational efficiency and effectiveness of research designs today. And that's very exciting. And that would have been likely impossible if I was in a traditional corporate role. But another area for me that I'm very passionate about is after all of these years of working for contract research companies, never working for a pharmaceutical company, a sponsor, I decided that I really wanted that experience. But rather than just go to work for a pharma, I found a business partner who, a great scientist who was very interested in spinning out a molecule from a quasi-academic organization. And we formalized a company around that. So now for the first time in my life, I'm on the sponsor side.
Wow.
And we're advancing a molecule. Hope to have our lead optimization medicinal chemistry completed very soon. Mm-hmm. And that whole process of non-clinical studies and onto clinical trials, it's very exciting to think about. And we've been able to obtain a couple $1 million of seed funding and have plans to advance to an A round at some point soon. But it's very exciting for me to have that experience as well.
It sounds it. So how does that, is it just yourself and your kind of business partner at this point on that, and with some sub consultants as well? Or are you now looking at expanding further offices? How does the setup look?
Yeah, we've got a small team of four original co-founders, and we're actually working with a pharmaceutical company's incubation team. So that's giving us some sort of preferential treatment being in a pharma incubator. And it's just a great experience. Sure. There's challenges, as you can imagine, and science is never easy, but being able to apply that passion for the business of science and helping the make sure that the funding is commensurate with the research needs, with all of the sequencing of events that needs to happen. For me, it's just so exciting, and I couldn't be more passionate about it.
So in terms of the work that you are now, like your core business, as it may be, your clients, what is the typical problem that you fix? Because that's normally, instead of any consulting job, it's normally like there's a problem that exists, and we approach them with a potential solution. And sometimes they don't even know that they have that problem. But what are the problems that you are typically fixing for your clients?
Sure. Yeah. Within the consulting practice, often life science companies have a very specific research design in mind, and they're trying to find the right data source. And historically, that's been very much just hopeful. I remember having questions, Matt, we need access to a large data set. Why? We've got this research project and we need to down select patients. We're conducting a retrospective study. And I thought, wow, how imprecise. Unfortunately, we're moving past that era of sort of big data. And we're realizing that it's the small, it's the highly specialized, or the small data set, as I jokingly call it, the small data is where it's really at. That's the high specificity data.
Right.
And getting to that requires precision. It requires an understanding of the study design and the research elements that are so critical to support the objectives and the use case itself. And so that's been facilitating that access, brokering some of those opportunities, really having that as a mindset, both on the life science side, but also on the data supply side. That's been the basis of the consulting practice, and occasionally weaving in some things from the decentralized research space. There could be some aspect of that where they want to use real world data to inform the design that then ultimately would become a decentralized trial, something like that.
Yeah. Wow. And in terms of, I guess, trying to put this all together and liaising with your clients, with your stakeholders, and just running a consultancy in general, what would you say have been the biggest challenges that you have faced to this point?
Yeah, for me, again, it's probably the bandwidth issue. Being able to address that with the contractors has certainly helped. It doesn't hurt being a workaholic if you're a consultant.
I know that feeling.
You have to have the discipline not to work. I think that is probably one of the biggest challenges that I've faced. It's knowing when to turn it off. And the downside of the home office is work is always there. It's a 10-second commute to the office. So you can always...
What does the wife make of that at times?
I've taken great, great efforts to try to really balance things. And so I do work the home office, departing for the day. See you later. I'm off to work. And then I merge 10, 11, 12 hours later. And I'm done. I try to be done. Maybe there's the occasional text message or something, but I really try to manage it that way.
Okay. Yeah, I ask because I run my business with Lucy, who's my partner. So often we're both in that situation. We're like, oh, there's never enough hours in the day, because you just realize that you could work 24/7.
Absolutely.
It's crazy. But look, we all do it because we're passionate about what we do.
For sure.
And we're normally striving for success in one way or another. So since starting, it's been 5+ years now for Riversight, at least.
That's right. Yeah. November of this year will actually be 6 years. And it's been a nice tenure. And while I enjoy consulting, I do have other interests. And I know one of your recent guests, Aaron Kamau, alluded to new and exciting things coming. And I'm very pleased that we're involved in that new exciting thing together and have more news on that very soon. But that as an entity is, I think, going to be very exciting. And,
nice.
And so if
we will see more of the partners in crime, will we, man?
Yes,
we'll
see
more of you both.
Absolutely. And of course, we'll have more of that on our Real World Wednesday show every Wednesday at 11 Eastern time.
Yeah.
We will be talking more and more about that.
Awesome stuff. But I guess, look, even speaking Real World Wednesday, must feel good running that as we covered at the top of the show here. But in terms of professional or business success under Riversight, is there one crowning moment that you've had so far, or one particular client? You don't necessarily need to name them, but like something that you've put together that has really made you think, you know what, I'm so glad that I took this gamble and went through those headaches of setting up the LLC and everything else that a lot of founders will, I'm sure, admit we know nothing about until we're actually doing it. Is there any major success that you've had and you've just been like, yes?
It's a great question, James, because I think the nature of consulting, it's rather than trying to find that big win, that big success story, it's the incremental wins. It's being able to have a very happy, a delighted client at the end of the day. You've done some project for them in a week and they're beaming with joy because now they can do something on within their role or with their team. And for me, that's the kind of reward that I'm looking for.
Yeah,
I don't have to have a big splash or a big opportunity, but just helping with that consistency and having those successes along the way, for me, that's very exciting because I know that I'm helping a lot of people in a lot of different areas, different use cases, and I really enjoy that.
I think that's one of the things that sometimes keeps us sane as well doing what we do is just having that drip feed of things from clients. Otherwise, it, as you say, you can easily get sucked into work, do so much things and just forget why we're doing it. So it's very relevant there. And you're talking about plans moving forward. It sounds like they are going to be interesting. Are you able to give us any insight about timescales on those, or
let's,
do you not know?
More is coming soon.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, what's next for yourself and Riversight, is that going to be more of the same, continuing to do what you do? Real World Wednesday, that's, I'm assuming, going to continue. Are you going to expand or diversify any of those existing practices at all? Or
I'll definitely keep consulting. The new thing will take some time, so that could shift a little bit of the focus, but I enjoy consulting and I enjoy working with clients so much. I don't see that ever going away, and probably just creating more opportunity for Real World Wednesday to tell more of those stories about real world data, its uses, the wonderful world of evidence generation, and what that means for life science, not only development, but also commercialization. Mm. And at the end of the day, the fact that there's a real impact, a real benefit from all of this data that's translated into evidence, there's a real benefit to patients, whether they understand or realize that or not, whether the individual clinicians realize that or not, it's almost immaterial because it is happening. And that's what's so exciting. And as it's better communicated, better messaged, as we're debasing concerns around the use of data. You hear that a lot. There's this rhetoric of, oh no, they've got access to my data. If it's an appropriate, ethical research study led by professionals with patient consent, or if it's de-identified data without, those are tremendous opportunities. And the patient has the opportunity to support research without lifting a finger. They don't have to do anything other than receive the clinical care that they receive all of the time. It's the data. It's that exhaust from the healthcare that occurs every day that is so exciting. It's that volume of data that is going to have a tremendous impact in the health of the future.
Awesome stuff. It'll be keen to, I will certainly be keen to follow what is next. Along the journey so far, however, is there one thing, or I guess what I'm asking is, what have you learned about yourself throughout this journey? Because it seems like there's been a few different stages, from entrepreneur to entrepreneur, from your former background doing your MBA and the international travel to now being home-based and consulting. What have you learned about yourself in terms of your characteristics or habits that have allowed you to make these switches?
The biggest thing that I've learned, James, is that I am a late-blooming entrepreneur. For many years, I was very passionate about the corporate roles, not necessarily just ratcheting up the ladder. I was never fixated on titles and things like that. I was much more passionate about the work that I was doing and if I had meaning and value from that. But as a late blooming entrepreneur, I've been able to do things that, I don't know, it's just so exciting. And I would encourage anyone who might be somewhat later career and not necessarily age, I'm in my early 50s, and it was just time. It was time to do it. And I'm so glad that I did, because now I've learned so much more about myself and just my drivers and what motivates me. And yet having those corporate experiences, I know that I can move back into an organization if I'm really passionate about that organization, or I can continue consulting. Ideally, I can do both, but it's that testing the limits of passions, interests, and capabilities. That for me has been the most prominent thing that I've learned over the last rapidly approaching 6 years.
Yeah, very nice. And you're looking very good for your early 50s as well. Solid.
Well, thank you.
But I think that also rolls me very nicely. We always close the show with a quick fire questions round, Matt. And I think that rolls me very nicely into my first one, which is, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
It is enjoy the process more. Enjoy the day-to-day of the work, or even before that in education. Having goals is very important. It's easy to focus more on achieving the goal than it is the process, but you have to enjoy the day-by-day more and more. And so that is a bit of advice that I would give myself if I could go back to the 20s and early 30s. It's, hey, enjoy what you're doing every day.
The result, when you do that, I guess the results come. So look, I like that.
That's right.
And to continue with my quick fire round, books, resources, you're a Clubhouse user. Is there a particular book or resource that you would recommend for our audience? Doesn't necessarily need to be work related, or anything that you go to regularly?
I do enjoy podcasts. My advice would be, you have to take time to think. And for me, that's in the form of exercise. I really enjoy cycling. I live in Colorado, so I can do in warmer months what's known as alpine cycling, which is road biking at about 10 to 12,000 feet or greater in elevation. Not many places in the world you can do that. But that alpine cycling, just being in literally a different ecosystem and fresh air and sunshine and just thinking, I've done some of my best work on the bicycle, because you're thinking through an issue. It's been daunting, or you're thinking about it in the background, and all of a sudden you have some solution or idea, and it was because you got away from the desk and the computer and you were able to think about things in a different way. And I don't see enough evidence of that in people today. Just time to think.
I like that. And you've unknowingly or knowingly wrapped up two of my quick fire questions there. I was going to say I was going to ask you about what your favorite thing outside of work is. Is cycling on the list, or is there anything else, Matt?
Cycling and sometimes go to the gym, basically just exercise categorically. A little bit of running. Joints aren't what they were in the 20s, 30s, so I don't
have to. This is what you're looking at, how you do in your early 50s, Matt. You're a good advocate for keeping fit and healthy here.
Well, thank you. No, I really enjoy exercise and nutrition and many of those aspects. I guess those roots that I learned in exercise physiology have paid dividends throughout my life, just because I've always enjoyed activity and encouraging others to be active. For a period of time, it was martial arts, encouraging my son to pursue martial arts, later team sports, and to see him active and fit. It's just, that's very rewarding.
Amazing. And I don't know how you've done it, but you've almost wrapped up my final quick fire question, and that is about your number one golden rule for life and business. It sounds like you've just summed it up. Is there anything else that you would add to that in terms of your number one golden rule for life and business, or is that it?
I think that probably is. That's probably it. Again, balance is a part of that. Maintaining, sometimes people will say, oh, work-life balance. And the workaholic side of me is, that's just an excuse not to work. It's real. You have to have that work-life balance. You have to have time to think. You have to have time to be a better resource for your clients, your colleagues. And those are lessons that come about over decades of experience. And
awesome stuff.
I'm thankful for every one of those experiences and all of the people that have helped shape me and thanking them. And I would say, as maybe a final point, James, if people have an impact, if people have helped you, some may not have even realized it. It's that process of going back and thanking them.
Amazing. I never would say that the quickfire round of our podcast is a test, but if it was, you would have aced that one because you covered all of the questions in less questions I even ask. So amazing stuff.
I'm a very consultant. Efficient. I'm all about efficiency. I'm a consultant. What can I say?
There you go. Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. For anyone Damn. That, you know, wants to look you up, I know you've got Real World Wednesday. Where else should people be checking you out or reaching out to
learn? Yeah, LinkedIn is by far the best. Easy to find. Matthew Veach, V like Victor, EATCH. It's funny, James, the T often throws people off because it's a silent T.
Right.
I've heard every variation of Viach, Vitic, Viach, but Veach, yeah, Matthew Veach. I welcome people's outreach on any facet of today's conversation. I love to connect with people and love to hear their drivers and motivators and anything I can do to help people be more successful. I'd love to do it.
Awesome. But thanks again for being part of the show.
Thank you so much, James. This was wonderful.